This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the Cold War, the CIA investigated many of its own agents who were suspected of secretly working for the Soviets. My guest David Wise says the mole hunt became so obsessive that it may have paradoxically crippled our efforts to spy on the Soviets. Wise is the author of several books about intelligence and espionage. His new book, Mole Hunt, chronicles the mole investigations of the 60s and 70s and tells the stories of the CIA agents whose careers were ruined by false accusations of disloyalty. In the 1980s, the CIA awarded financial compensation for damages to three of the men it had earlier accused of betrayal. The mole hunt began in 1961 when a KGB agent in Helsinki went to the CIA station chief there and asked for American asylum.
Well, Anatoly Golitsyn was a counterintelligence officer working for the KGB in Helsinki, and he appeared on the doorstep in the snow one dark evening of Frank Freiberg, who was the station chief in Helsinki for the CIA. He appeared there with his wife and his young daughter, who stood there in the snow clutching a little doll. And Frank Freiberg didn't speak Russian. He spoke fluent Finnish. And Anatoly Golitsyn did not speak very much English or Finnish. And he kept saying, "Asul, Asul." And Mr. Freiberg, whom I interviewed, didn't know what that word Asul meant. But finally, Golitsyn wrote it out on a piece of paper, and he realized from the letters, A-S-Y-L, that he was seeking asylum and that he suddenly had a KGB defector on his hand, a walk-in, the dream of every CIA officer to get a walk-in. Not only the walk-in, but his entire family. And he didn't tell Freiberg very much on what became a long and somewhat comical trip to New York and then to CIA headquarters in Langley. But when he reached Virginia and was debriefed, he said, "There is a mole inside the CIA. His name begins with letter K. Our code name, that is the KGB code name for this man, was Sasha. And his background is Slavic, and his name may have begun with, ended with the letters Ski, S-K-Y. And he worked in Germany for a while. Those were the elements that he knew, but he didn't know the man's name or his true identity."
Now, how did that lead to Peter Carlo, who was the chief of special equipment at the CIA?
Well, the moment that Golitsyn said that the mole's name began with the letter K, then everyone whose name began with letter K fell under suspicion. And, you know, it was as though, at the height of this, it was as though everyone was under suspicion. But to begin with, anyone whose name certainly began with letter K. Now, Peter Carlo was head of the Technical Equipment Board, which was working on copying a bug that had been found inside the Great Seal of the United States that had been hanging in the office of the United States ambassadors to the Soviet Union. And I use the word ambassadors plural advisedly because it had been there on the wall during about five ambassadors for several years. And Golitsyn said that the KGB was aware of the CIA effort. So the fact that the Russians seemed to know about the work that this group was doing, that Carlo headed, was, of course, one factor that pointed toward him. But there were others as well. Carlo had been born with the name Klebanski, and the family had changed its name when he was a young fellow growing up in New York. And he had served in Germany for the CIA. And in addition to that, his background was Slavic to the extent that his father, who was named Klebanski, had originally, I suppose, had some roots in Eastern Europe. So he seemed to fit the profile of the mole. But Peter Carlo, as it turned out, was a loyal American and a war hero. And the CIA seemed to pay no attention to the fact that, for example, in the OSS, Peter Carlo had been on a PT boat that blew up on a very daring mission against the Nazis off of the coast of Italy. And at age 22, the boat blew up and Peter Carlo lost his left leg. And he got a Bronze Star from General Wild Bill Donovan, the head of the OSS, and which, of course, was our spy agency in World War II. And he was a distinguished officer with an impeccable war record and had been placed in charge of gadgets for the agency, roughly equivalent to the Q in the James Bond movies, the gadgeteer in those films and books, and had established himself as a very valuable member of the CIA. All of this went out the window in the atmosphere of suspicion and fear and panic that gripped the agency when they were told that somewhere in their ranks was a mole.
How credible was Galitzin, the Soviet defector who said that there was a mole in the CIA? I mean, didn't he also say that Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir was a spy?
He implied that to Frank Freiberg on the way home. He didn't say it flat out, but that was what he suspected because he had heard that a prominent Israeli had visited the Soviet Union and had been involved with the KGB, and the only person who had visited at that time, he thought, was Golda Meir. Galitzin was able to persuade James Angleton, the chief of counterintelligence and a very spooky, legendary figure, now dead inside the CIA, that the agency was shot through with moles. He, as far as his reliability, he also persuaded Angleton, I think it's fair to say, was one of the people who persuaded Angleton, certainly, that the Sino-Soviet split was, in fact, a fraud, that really the Russians and the Chinese were getting along fine. Well, of course, almost no scholar or independent authority thought that at all. And he had various other theories that were equally unbelievable.
Why was James Angleton, who was the CIA's head of counterintelligence, why was he so obsessed with finding moles?
Well, that was his job. It certainly was the main part of his job. The chief of counterintelligence is a subject that is not a phrase or a word, if you wish, that is not very well understood because it gets confused with counterespionage, which is part of it. But basically, counterintelligence as a one of Angleton's deputies told me, and I think it's a good definition, is a mechanism to counter intelligence of the other side, that is, to fight the intelligence forces, in this case of the Soviet Union, of the KGB and the GRU, their military intelligence. And it does so by, of course, trying to find penetrations inside the American government, inside the CIA and other agencies. But it also, and this is a little less well known, tries to protect the operations of the CIA against penetration by the KGB. So the counterintelligence staff tries to make sure that the people the CIA recruits and the operations it runs are not really being controlled in Moscow.
Well, Angleton would sometimes go to extremes. I mean, Tom Braden, who was the assistant to Alan Dulles, the CIA's deputy director for plans, said that he thought James Angleton had actually bugged his bedroom in the 1950s.
That's an interesting story. Tom Braden, as you know, is an author. He also was the host of Crossfire on CNN. He's a well-known writer and television personality. And Tom Braden had worked in the CIA back in those days, and as you say, as assistant to Alan Dulles. And one day, as he told me, he was speaking with his wife, Joan, in the bedroom, and he made a reference to the fact that Dulles was disliked by Beadle Smith. General Walter Beadle Smith was the head of the CIA at the time, and Dulles worked for him, as did Braden. And the next morning, Dulles called him in and said, "What's this about Beadle not liking me?" And Braden sort of fumbled around and said, "Well, I don't know anything about that." And then Dulles repeated the conversation word for word, and Braden realized that Dulles had him dead to rights, and he also realized that his bedroom must have been bugged. So he then admitted that he had made a remark like that. And Dulles then said, "Well, you better be careful because Jimmy's got his eye on you." And he meant, obviously, James Angleton.
Weird story. When Peter Carlo became the primary suspect of being the mole in the CIA, he had no recourse, in part because the accusations had to be kept secret. The CIA didn't want anyone to know that this investigation was underway. So I guess Carlo's hands were really tied.
Well, yes, the whole business was out straight out of Kafka, where you're accused of something, you don't know what you're accused of, you don't know who your accuser is, and you're not allowed to say anything about it. And since Kafka liked the letter K, too. I think that's appropriate. but, you know, that was one of the ironies here. Angleton called Carlo in when he was under investigation and said, now, this is all top secret. You can't tell anyone about this. So he was not only accused, and his whole life and career and loyalty to this country were on the line, but he was told he couldn't tell about it. It was a CIA secret that he'd been accused.
So he basically was forced to resign?
He was. In 1963, he was forced out. He was given no choice. And it was a shattering moment for him. At one point, he even had to assure his own wife that he wasn't a Soviet mole. And he found himself adrift at the age of 42, I think, with his career shattered. Unfortunately, he was able to get a job as an executive of a Fortune 500 company, and he was able to take care of himself and his family and his children, but he fought for 26 years to clear his name of this terrible injustice that had been done.
Well, how do you fight to clear your name of a charge that's been kept a secret?
Well, one thing he did was to hire a very smart lawyer who had been a clandestine operator for the CIA, a man named Stanley Gaines, and Gaines was able to go to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And the history of it was this, that in 1980, two other CIA officials who had been mistreated by the agency as suspected moles were able to persuade, again with the help of lawyer Gaines, were able to persuade the Senate Intelligence Committee to pass a law that nobody knew about, very obscure law, but within the CIA, it became known as the Mole Relief Act. And under that law, Paul Garbler, who had been our first station chief in Moscow for the CIA, and another man named Richard Kovich, another distinguished CIA operator, both of whom had had their careers damaged by the mole hunt, were compensated under the Mole Relief Act. And meanwhile, Peter Carlo had applied and was turned down because they told him that even though it was found that he was not a mole, other matters had come up, other security questions had come up about him, so that he didn't qualify. And the other security questions, it seems very clear to me, and I've researched this thoroughly, were matters that they decided to frame Carlo with, because he, if they couldn't hang him for a sheep, they would hang him for a lamb. In other words, they were determined to get rid of him, so they found some minor violations. I think he had left a document once in a coffee can, that sort of thing. And there were other things involving his father's background. All of it was nonsense. All of it was minor. And they used it to force him out. But in 1988, at the request of Carlo and his lawyers, Congress repassed the Mole Relief Act again. It was with no public knowledge. And Carlo was paid close to $500,000 by the CIA to recompense him for the damage that had been done. And not only that, he was given a secret medal in a secret ceremony by William Webster, the director of the CIA, and that took place in the spring of 1989.
The medal was a secret?
Yeah, well, in the sense that it was never announced. And I would say that it wasn't a secret to Carlo and his friends, but it was certainly not known to the public that any of this had happened.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Wise, who has been writing about the CIA for many years. His new book is called Mole Hunt, The Secret Search for Traitors That Shattered the CIA. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. David Wise is my guest, author of many books about the CIA. His new book is called Mole Hunt. When William Colby became the head of the CIA, he got rid of Angleton. What were his reasons for doing that?
Well, I talked to Colby at length about that. And essentially, Colby felt that he simply could not figure out what Angleton was doing. Angleton was supposed to be a brilliant man who understood all of these convoluted nerve endings and cases and relationships that only he could somehow decipher. But frankly, Colby just never knew what the heck he was doing. Not only that, Colby was very well aware of two other things, that operations against the Soviets had come to a halt. And secondly, He couldn't forgive the fact that his own officers were coming under suspicion, and unfair suspicion, and that careers had been damaged. So he felt that Angleton had acquired too much power and that the counterintelligence staff had acquired too much power, and that he began slowly dismantling Angleton's empire, taking away pieces of the empire, bureaucratic parts of the counterintelligence staff, hoping that gradually, as the empire was whittled down, Angleton would get the message and quit. But he never did. I asked Colby why he never fired Angleton outright until 1974, when he finally did. And Colby said, with some hesitation, he said he was afraid that Angleton might take his own life. And so he waited until finally he felt he could not wait any longer, and he fired him.
I'd like to get into something that's, in a way, a sidebar to the main story that we're trying to tell during this interview, but it's an important part of your book, and it's a fascinating story, especially with people being so absorbed again with the Kennedy assassination. And I'm thinking of the story of Yuri Nasenko, who was also a Soviet defector who defected in 1964 in Geneva, and he said that he had handled the Lee Harvey Oswald case during the period that Oswald lived in the Soviet Union. And he told the CIA that the Soviet Union decided it never really, it wasn't going to be interested in Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yes, that's an important part of my book. I tell all of that involvement of Nasenko with Oswald. Nasenko was very important in the book because Golitsyn said that defectors who followed him would be plants, would be false defectors, and that Nasenko was one, by inference. And Nasenko said things such as, well, we weren't interested in Oswald, and when Oswald tried to commit suicide after he, Nasenko, had told Oswald he couldn't remain in the Soviet Union, that the KGB was then overruled, that was Nasenko's story, and at a higher political level, they told Oswald he could stay. The reason, according to Nasenko, that the Soviets thought it would be bad for, from a publicity point of view, for American-Soviet relations and so on, if Oswald tried to commit suicide again and might have succeeded the second time. So he was allowed to stay. Well, Nasenko's story on this and many other points, even though he provided very valuable information, was not believed by the counterintelligence staff. And Nasenko was imprisoned for 5 years by the CIA, which was entirely illegal as far as I can tell. And for about half of that time, he was kept in a concrete cell on the farm, which is the CIA training base, 10,000-acre training base near Williamsburg, Virginia, for a long time not allowed ever to see the sky, and constantly interrogated by people who simply felt that he was lying about everything, including Oswald.
So what do you think, looking back and trying to put all the story in perspective? Do you think he was telling the truth about Oswald, and do you think what he had to say reveals anything about the Kennedy assassination case?
Yes, I think that he was telling the truth essentially about Oswald. All defectors puff themselves up and tell things that aren't true to try to make themselves look important. But essentially, I think the story of what he told about Oswald probably, in retrospect, was true, that Oswald was not a KGB agent, was allowed to stay for the reasons that he stated, and so on.
Another facet of the story that will be of interest to people who are following the assassination story is that Nasenko, the defector, said that although Oswald had a reputation in the West of being a terrific shot, in the Soviet Union they found that he was really a lousy hunter. He was a terrible shot.
Yeah, according to Nasenko, they had to usually give him a rabbit or two when he went out on a hunt because he couldn't shoot them. And that's puzzling.
Yeah, what do you make of it?
The whole world of intelligence is puzzling.
Yeah.
You can't always, there aren't easy answers to any of these things.
Yeah, and you've been in this world for a long time. You must just be dizzy with this information. I mean, you're as deep into it as a lot of the CIA guys are.
Well, I think that many CIA people reading my book will find out things they didn't know.
Let me just ask you quickly, because we only have a couple of minutes left, and this, I'm sure, would really take hours to really answer. But have you been keeping up with the Pentagon's efforts to redefine itself, and then, you know, the CIA's efforts to redefine itself in the post-Cold War era?
Well, certainly. The Pentagon seems to want to be the policeman of the world. I thought we'd gotten over that somehow a few years ago. And the CIA, and this is very interesting, Robert Gates is talking about the need to emphasize human intelligence, whereas up to now, there's been great emphasis, certainly for the last two decades, on spy satellites and technical means of intelligence. And the whole trend had been to the satellites, to the overhead photography, and to the fact that we no longer needed spies in back alleys, cloak and dagger operators. Now, especially since the Persian Gulf War, they've come back to the idea that they really need people on the ground. They really need people in trench coats because they're the only ones who can find out the intentions of an adversary. It won't help to photograph Saddam Hussein from 250 miles in space. You may photograph his bunker or even get a picture of him, but it's not going to tell you what's going on inside his head or what he's planning to do. So the old boys, whom I write about on Mole Hunt, a new generation of them looks like they're going to be recruited and be back in business.
Well, David Wise, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
David Wise is the author of several books about U.S. intelligence. His latest is called Mole Hunt, and it's just been published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.